Thanks for listening to Latino USA. And now a question for you. What if MacGyver worked at NPR? Well, he kind of does. Check out the How to Do Everything podcast with Mike and Ian. When you need to know how to find a date or find water in the desert, Mike and Ian are there for you. How to Do Everything is modern life lessons from NPR. It's also seriously funny. Find How to Do Everything now at itunes.com/NPR. From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And for me, at that moment, I said, you know what? I want to spend the rest of my life with you.
When it comes to love, sometimes you just know. But it doesn't mean you get to stay together. We hear about one couple trying to work magic to be with each other. And two friends separated by segregation.
I used to rib them a lot about being married because they acted more like a married couple than friends, you know.
And we hear about the political passion of Chuy Garcia in Chicago challenging Rahm Emanuel. And the Smithsonian Portrait Gallery embraces Latino artists. All this and more coming up on Latino USA as we talk about love and loss. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today, stories about love and loss. But first, all right, people, stick with me here. You know me as a journalist, and so that means I love politics. But as a teenager, I couldn't have cared less. My senior year in high school, though, I got turned on to electoral politics. I learned to love street politics and the rough and tumble of community organizing in the Mexicano neighborhood of Pilsen in Chicago. And the person who turned me on to this was Chuy Garcia. Like me, he's a Mexicano and Americano, and he's from Chicago. And he also happens to be running for mayor of that great city. Now, just for the record, this is not an endorsement, but in Chicago's political life, few Latinos have ever run for mayor, let alone won. And so we thought it was worth taking some time to hear from him. Chuy Garcia, welcome to Latino USA.
Great to join you today to talk about love of politics and love of Chicago neighborhood.
Yeah, exactly. So Chuy, you know, you did teach me to love electoral politics. I remember thinking that you actually knew that what we were doing at that time was making history in the late 70s, early 80s, getting the first Latino on the ballot in Chicago. How did you learn to love that kind of politics when you didn't have, you know, specifically any Latino role models?
I think it was my neighborhood grounding and rootedness in growing up in both the Pilsen and Little Village communities and being able to, you know, walk through the alleys and walk through gangways and get a real understanding of how a neighborhood works that got me to really ask a lot of questions about why are things this way? Why is this part of the neighborhood neglected? Why are other parts favored? Why do they get good services? Why do they look better? And I think that that's what really drove me to ask bigger questions about who makes decisions? Who are the folks that call the shots? Who has power? Who doesn't have power? Who can have power? And it was the last question that I think just fueled my drive to say, why can't more people have power and participate in creating the conditions in a neighborhood?
The truth is that you are up against, you know, another Chicago machine, Rahm Emanuel, Obama's first chief of staff. So your chances don't look so good. So what keeps you loving this fight, even if you know that there could be a possible loss at the end of it?
What keeps me loving it is the people in Chicago's neighborhoods who are yearning to become connected to each other, who are seeing more common ground in some of the suffering that they've experienced after the Great Recession of 2008. For example, my opponent in this race, the incumbent mayor Rahm Emanuel, has raised over $30 million in the past 5 years to engage in, you know, tremendous TV buys that want to paint the prettiest picture of the city of Chicago, when people in the neighborhoods are saying, you know, that's not really my Chicago. I disagree with the characterization that everything is, you know, hunky-dory in Chicago. I don't mind being the underdog. I think it's important for us to continue to speak out, to be daring enough to offer a different alternative, a different vision. And I find satisfaction in thinking about that. I find satisfaction in bringing to people saying, can't we change that reality? And really in engaging in wanting to transform the city in a positive way for the masses, for the ordinary people.
So do you feel like the fight that you're fighting now in Chicago is in a way similar to the fight that you see Latinos on a national level taking on?
I think this election is an election about raising the voice of those who are voiceless, raising the voice of the crisis in Chicago as it relates to unemployment and revitalization of communities that have been disinvested for a long time. There's a desire to have Chicago become a safer city. Latinos are a growing part of the population and electorate in places like the New South. And if their voices are heard in Chicago with a strong Latino turnout, that can bode well for that community, can place them on the map. This is a movement about empowerment. It's a movement about the crisis in urban American cities and the need for Congress to address it and to change the reality of many people by providing them opportunities to work. That is really the seed of the violence that we experience in Chicago, having had over 10,000 shootings over the past 4 years and over 1,800 homicides. That's intolerable, and that's why we're fighting in this election.
Chuy Garcia, good luck.
Thank you.
Chuy Garcia is a member of the Cook County Board of Commissioners. He's also a candidate in Chicago's mayoral race. Now, Chuy Garcia fell in love with politics in Chicago during the 1970s. A decade later, Fabrián and Gabriela Cerejido fell in love with each other in New York City. Fabrián and Gabriela are the parents of our producer, Antonia Cerejido. She brings us the story of how these two Argentine immigrants fell in love and came to El Norte from the Way Sur.
She loves me, loves me, loves me. We always had a real girl. Tinky, tink, tink, ti-ding, tink, tinky, tink, tink, ti-ding.
That was Fabián Cerejido's semi-accurate rendition of Denise Williams' Let's Hear It for the Boy. The song came out in 1984, the year he met my mom, Gabriela Simón.
Her hair was enormous. She was gorgeous.
I had 80s hair.
She had 80s hair, right.
My mom had come only 10 days earlier from Buenos Aires. She had come to study modern dance. My dad had already been in New York City for some months. He had come to study visual art.
I asked you for your phone number.
Mm-hmm.
I took the plunge. I invited her to go to the Metropolitan Museum. And then we went to the Venetian room. And then in front of Veronese's Venus and Mars, I made my first move.
And how'd it go?
It went well. I put my arm around her shoulder.
So we went to the deli and we were chatting. And at one point, I thought that he was trying to hold my hand on the table. But he was actually trying to move some crumbs off the table.
How did you decide to move in together? And, like, how long after you met did that happen?
That was crazy. I said, I want to move. She said, we could look together. And it was ambiguous. It wasn't clear if this was about going to the same realtor or, you know, together in the sense that we're going to look for a place in which we could live together.
And when did it become not ambiguous?
we started to be a couple, we said, okay, let's move together.
But what was that, like a week or?
Yeah, probably a week. I don't know if I want you to put this out.
We were really into each other, and it was awkward, though. I remember when I went to pick her up in Queens, that suddenly we were with the suitcase in the on the subway, and we're looking at each other like, whoa, what are we doing? But it was great. Because we then we had like these very long conversations about everything. We didn't know anything about one another. I didn't know anything about the world of dance. She took me to see everything. I took her to see art.
What was it like seeing mom perform?
Yeah, it was wonderful. I remember one, it was raining and it was a combination dance and welding experience. And so there were these guys building a big metal thing, and Gabby was dancing in the rain. I wasn't big on marriage. I was of the persuasion that it's a piece of paper. But then once we were kissing, and I said, Gabby, I want to marry you. And she said yes.
Mm-hmm. Months start to pass by, then years start to pass by, and you realize that you're building a career in New York.
My parents loved living in New York, but it wasn't all sunshine and roses.
Once I was tried, I left the key inside the car. And when I came with a clothes hanger to try to, you know, make a hook and hook this thing, there was a guy who saw me doing that and assumed that I was trying to steal the car. And so they started shooting drugs right next to me. And I mean, a different illegal activity, but hey.
Yeah, they wanted to be close together with the
cozy,
other league.
Cozy, right. Yeah. But then I didn't imagine myself with a baby, you know, going around all these, having to cross the street or being nervous about, you know.
They had financial concerns.
We were never very good about making money within the arts. When we decided we wanted to have kids, we said, okay, let's go back and study.
Both of my parents went back to college, ended up getting PhDs, and are now professors living in LA.
Do you feel, how American do you feel?
I feel quite American. I mean, if there's a game, Argentina, the US, in soccer, I want Argentina to win, but just like 1-0.
I have some friends from Europe who had this vision that coming to the United States was a way of being in a more spontaneous place, freer. And in my case, it was the other way around. I found structure here.
Y papush?
I'm still looking for structure. And also having such a sense of belonging with your mom, then there's always that nucleus that you say, okay, art will always be there.
I really feel like 30 years ago.
Yeah, no, because we kept this thing also of having the conversations. It's like but we have a lot of mutual enthusiasm and the conversations.
For Latino USA, I'm Antonia Cerejido.
Coming up on Latino USA.
Each room is very, very different, and it's like peeking into a different window, a different narrative, a different history.
The Smithsonian Portrait Gallery finally shows Latinos some love. Stay with us. No se vayan.
support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, maker of the Dreamwave massage chair, Japanese crafted with shiatsu point detection and 16 pre-programmed massages, including morning, night, and full body sessions. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, we're talking about love and loss. And many of us first experience both with our families. What if we took all the moments of our lives and put them alongside our parents or our children's? What would we see? Well, a workshop in the Bronx did just that, when organizers sent Latino parents and their children off into the city with disposable cameras to capture their lives. The project inspired an exhibit, Dos Generaciones, or Two Generations. Kayla DeRoche spoke with a father and a daughter to find out what it means to be Mexican in New York City.
I met Joel and Natalie Cortez at Joel's office, where he works as a graphic designer. It was huge, with streamlined furniture and modern art. Joel loves art, and when he heard about the photography workshop, he thought it would be a good thing for his daughter, Natalie, to do.
So I asked her, you want to join? Photography is really nice. You can learn a lot of new things, like art and how to do this, that. Who knows, maybe you'll like it. And then she tried it out, and the teacher said she had a good eye for photography.
It was awesome. And the first day, I learned so much. They gave me a notebook and a pencil. And not only that, but they gave me a free Hershey bar.
And a disposable camera. Natalie got one, and her father got one. Natalie is 12 years old, and her photos are a reflection of a city childhood. Toddlers in striped shirts play in a jungle gym. A woman wearing a blue hijab pushes her little boy in a swing. And bright yellow dandelions push up from between pavement cracks. Faith plays a role in these images. And one, a statue of the Virgin of Guadalupe, stands in front of a store below the train tracks. Golden rays shoot out from behind her.
She's one of my favorite of them all, like Jesus. But it's because times get rough, but you just pray to her, and she will reward you back and make you think about what you've done and show you the right path.
Joel's photos show the streets of the city. A food cart on a busy sidewalk, a bicycle chained to a rack, and the Empire State Building soaring up to the sky.
New York City is identified by these buildings. For me, when I was a young boy, I used to see them as ginormous, ginormous buildings, and like kind of scary because they were so giant.
And then he started persuading me to like structures and find everything amazing. I think architecture is my thing, and also because it involves math. And I may not like math, but I'm actually pretty good at it. And I think I will pursue my dream to be an architect.
Joel tells Natalie that the way to get there is to study hard, because it was something he did not do.
First of all, my major was art, and it was a specialized high school, art and design high school. And I worked the whole year, 2 years, to get into that high school. I was just slacking around with my friends, cutting school. And by the time I got to junior year, I had very little credits. So they had to kick me out. I even begged them on my knees, and they said no. So I had to accept it. So from there, I just started working.
And he did a lot of jobs.
A CD distributor, a pizza cook, a line cook.
A lot.
Cashier, Starbucks, Frappuccino maker. Oh, yeah, and a butcher assistant. By the end of the day, I would be smelling like blood, like awful, awful, just awful.
Joel doesn't want Natalie to follow the same steps he did. And for now, she's on the honor roll at school. She also takes singing classes. And what she really loves are traditional Mexican songs, including this classic.
Ay, 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 canta y no llores, porque cantando se alegran cielito lindo los corazones.
Whether you're Mexican-American or not, from this generation or the last, we all learn from our parents' mistakes and strengths. And like her father, Joel, Natalie approaches life with energy and hope. Part of optimism is recognizing the light in your life. That could be your family, a walk in the park, or the flash from a camera. I'm Kayla DeRoche for Latino USA.
You can find out more about the workshop and see photos from the Dos Generaciones exhibit at latinousa.org. Our nation's capital, the Smithsonian Complex of Museums is, in some ways, the intellectual and artistic heart of our nation. And for a long time, Latino exhibits were lacking. But these days, new staff and artworks are coming on board to highlight the contributions of Latino artists. Lauren Landau visited the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C. to see what's behind it all.
Museums aren't the first place you'd expect to find screaming children. But on a rainy Saturday in Washington, dozens of kids are running around the National Portrait Gallery's indoor courtyard learning about Hispanic culture. 6-year-old Samaya has a colorful personality and dress to match.
I'm dancing for a parade.
What kind of clothes are you wearing?
I'm wearing the
Payola.
Payola dress because it's from the 80s. 1800s.
Samaya's here for Family Day to celebrate an exhibit called Portraiture Now, Staging the Self. It features work by 6 contemporary Latino artists. Michael Vasquez, who's in his early 30s, is one of them. He stopped by to help the kids make some art of their own.
The whole idea is to represent neighborhood and community.
Those are 2 key themes in Michael's large-scale paintings, which reflect his years growing up in Miami as the only child of a single mom.
When I became of age and was able to venture out into the neighborhood, obviously I met the other kids there, and they were sort of involved in this neighborhood street gang.
Michael says he was attracted to the way the guys commanded respect and exuded an almost stereotypical sense of masculinity. But in an oil painting called The Neighborhood Tour, he challenges that cliché.
It's not all bad, you know?
A young man dressed all in black straddles a green bicycle, loosely wrapping a supportive arm around a smiling child who sits on the handlebars.
Obviously, there are definitely problems, like with gang culture and everything, but there's another side to that, you know, where people are caring and compassionate, especially for other kids within their community.
The size of Michael's work is also intentional. Take the 8-foot-tall painting of a bare-chested guy. Long, stringy hair hangs over the red bandana that covers his eyes and forehead. His fists are tattooed, and his knuckles lock together, forming a city skyline and the words Gulf Coaster.
It makes sense to magnify the scale and paint them really big, and then that, in turn, also forces the viewer to look up to the sitter just as I did growing up.
This is the first exhibition where the wall texts are bilingual in English and Spanish.
That's Latino art and history curator Taina Caragol, who led the team that put Staging the Self together. Last year, the Smithsonian Latino Center helped fund her position as part of its nationwide effort to make sure Latino cultural contributions get the recognition they deserve. Taina's goal is to normalize the presence of U.S. Latinos.
I say normalize because currently, if you walk through our galleries, you know, we're a history museum that tells the history of the U.S. through portraits of people who have made contributions of national impact. There are very few people of U.S. Latino background in the permanent collection.
Forget conventional portraits here. The whole name of the exhibit, Staging the Self, means identity is fluid and defined by the artists themselves.
Each room is very, very different, and it's like peeking to a different window, a different narrative, a different history.
That's artist David Antonio Cruz. There are no seated subjects with serious faces in his work. Instead, there's plastic fruit, broken plates, and paper planes made from copies of Ellis Island documents. Thick brown paint, a metaphor for chocolate-toned skin, drips down his canvases. As the son of Puerto Ricans who moved to the mainland, David meditates on being both a person of color and the child of an immigrant.
There's not quite this blending of the two, and you don't really exist in either space, so it becomes this pot of things that don't quite blend, and I think of the work in that way.
Panamanian-American artist Rochelle Mosman knows what he means.
Any first-generation person lives with one foot in their parents' culture and one foot in the culture in which they're growing up. So that was always this huge conflict for me, because you don't really know how to house all of these different parts of your identity.
Rochelle's mother is her muse and model. In some of the photos, her mom is both the maid and her much lighter-skinned employer. One image shows her with arms outstretched, floating in an empty pool.
It's this narrative that the lady of the home, you know, and all the family is gone, so the maid can finally take a dip in the pool.
In her uniform.
She says the National Portrait Gallery's effort to include more Latino art is a baby step, but a great moment for these American artists. The gallery hopes to become fully bilingual by 2018 and to eventually include other languages. For Latino USA, I'm Lauren Landau in Washington, D.C.
To check out some of the paintings from the Staging the Self exhibit, visit our website, latinousa.org. It isn't always just between romantic partners and family. Love can also be very real between friends. To talk about that love, we're going to take you to the graveyard. There are three cemeteries in the small town of Marfa, Texas. They're divided by fencing and by race. Though segregation seems like a dated practice, the separations between whites and Latinos are still visible among the departed. Mia Warren has our story.
So where we're at right now, this is a Catholic cemetery. It's the first Hispanic or Mexican cemetery.
That's Alberto Garcia.
Native of Marfa, born and raised throughout the 50s, 60s. I work at Marfa Public Library. I'm the assistant librarian. Pretty neat, you know, get to meet a lot
in
of people.
In the borderlands of West Texas, intermarriage between whites and Hispanics is hardly rare. But in death, people remain segregated. One cemetery is known as the Anglo Cemetery. The other two, Cementerio de la Merced and the Marfa Catholic Cemetery, are Latino. I meet up with Garcia at the Catholic Cemetery. We stand among rows of tombstones and modest makeshift crosses adorned with artificial bouquets, about 100 feet from the railroad tracks. On the other side of a fence is the Anglo Cemetery. Unlike here, the plots on that side are well-groomed, full of grass. The division isn't just aesthetic.
Well, it was not legally segregated, but it was segregated by custom.
That's historian Lon Taylor, a former curator at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. He says before the 1970s, West Texas towns had separate schools, barbershops, and churches. Even movie theaters had their own unwritten rules about where to sit.
Anglos sat in the center part of the theater, and Mexicans were expected to sit on the sides.
It was an accepted way of life until the late 60s. Garcia says if you were white or Hispanic growing up here, you knew where you were supposed to be. But what about if you were neither white nor Hispanic? In the corner of the Anglo Cemetery is a small patch of land scattered with a few gravestones where you'll find the answer.
Yeah, George and Cheney were the only blacks in Marfa when I was growing up.
George Livingston and Grannis and Cheney were good friends who moved to Marfa in the 1930s. Cheney shined shoes for a living, but he's best remembered for his small part in the 1954 Western film Giant. Livingston was a chef at the Hotel Paisano and operated a barbecue restaurant for many years.
I used to rib them a lot about being married because they acted more like a married couple than friends, you know. They were always bickering, you know. They were always fighting, you know. They were always arguing.
Both men were favorites in the community until their deaths. Chaney in 1972, Livingston 2 years later.
Funny thing was, Chaney identified more with the white community, whereas George lived in the Hispanic part of town, and so he was more involved with the Hispanic people, you know.
Chaney and Livingston had forged ties with the white and Latino communities. So why were both buried in the white cemetery only a few years after integration and within a decade of the signing of the Civil Rights Act?
Basically, they were buried by the county as paupers.
Their part of the cemetery is known as the Pauper's Corner. It's separated from the rest of the tombs by a small gravel path. The graves themselves are simple stone markers surrounded by patches of weeds.
And the flat marker reads Granison, Chaney, 1893, 1972, and it says loyal citizen. And then right next to him is George Livingston, 1901, 1974, Paisano Hotel Chief. They were paupers as far as, you know, dying in Marfa with no resources and no family to take care of the arrangements.
It's kind of crazy because we're seeing race, religion, culture, socioeconomic status is explaining how everything's laid out here.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I talked to a couple other people about this, and some people said, oh, well, it's not a racial thing, it's a religious thing.
I think it's more along the racial lines than religion, really. Yeah. That's the Mexican cemetery, and this is the gringo cemetery, you know.
But over the generations, intermarriage has created a few exceptions to that. In the Latino cemeteries, you can find the odd Anglo name, like Watts or Hartnett. It seems love can cut across boundaries, even among the dead. For Latino USA, I'm Mia Warren in Marfa, Texas.
Coming up on Latino USA.
As a long-distance couple visiting each other, you're not living as a couple anyway.
The challenges of a faraway love. Stay with us. No se vayan. Thanks for listening to Latino USA, and now a question for you. What if MacGyver worked at NPR? Well, he kind of does. Check out the How to Do Everything podcast with Mike and Ian. When you need to know how to find a date or find water in the desert, Mike and Ian are there for you. How to Do Everything is modern life lessons from NPR. It's also seriously funny. Find How to Do Everything now at iTunes.com/NPR. Yeah.
junto a casa, nadie en la puerta. Hoy con el pasillo y la cama desierta. Siempre es invierno cuando no me pesa. Giro los discos, paro la ruleta. Está moviendo otro dólar, otro día. Camina saltos la madre natura. Muerto Khan, murieron los profetas. Mi fe ciega, de dos en dos y tú callabas. Y yo en el uno, en la mesura. Como un Buda, con cuatro mentiras no presentura.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, with a floor finder app to help find sustainably harvested flooring, including exotic and domestic hardwood, bamboo, and cork. More information is available at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfutures.org.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and we're continuing our exploration today about love and loss. The new film, An Honest Liar, follows Canadian-American magician James Randi as he travels the globe performing magic shows and debunking pseudoscience. Randi is working on his 11th book about the history of magic and his famous pursuit of truth. At the same time, his partner, an artist from Venezuela, has engineered a more complicated type of deception. Anna Adlerstein has the story.
I was very young when I just started having these feelings towards other men, but there was absolutely no way I was going to tell my father or my mother or not even my friends. I just didn't have any role models to follow.
When Davy Peña was growing up in Caracas in the 1970s, it was dangerous to be gay.
The police would go into any particular bar and just take everybody. Once they did that, they would publish their photographs on the newspapers. And that was the kiss of death for all of them. I was just constantly harassed. I just needed to leave.
Davy came to the U.S. on a student visa to study art. One day, he was in the Fort Lauderdale Library researching space imagery when a small man with a thick white beard peered over the book he was reading.
This beard, you know, could fool some people, but it's not a disguise. No, I wear it because it grows out of my face.
And then he said that he had a telescope at his home, and he said, look. And I looked through the viewfinder, and I saw Saturn with the rings. And as I was looking, the planet left the field of the viewfinder. And I look up Randi and I said, it moved. And Randi said, no, the Earth moved. And for me at that moment, I said, you know what? I want to spend the rest of my life with you.
Davy's new love wasn't just some guy named Randi. He was the amazing Randi.
Gentlemen. The amazing
a MacArthur Genius Award winner whose mission in life was to keep magicians honest and, in particular, expose fake paranormal activity.
The life of Harry Houdini reads very similar to the life of James Randi.
If you're going to get your head cut off, you go to the best guy.
But there was one major problem with this budding romance. Davy's visa was about to expire. In order to stay in the U.S. and with Randi, he procured false identification documents.
He did what he had to do.
Davy took on the identity of Jose Alvarez. That meant more than just a new social security number. Davy introduced himself as Jose at parties, signed his paintings Jose. Then, 60 Minutes invited Randi to Australia to expose New Age channelers as frauds. He enlisted Jose as his assistant and gave him yet another identity.
And we created a booklet called the Words or the Wise Word.
No, what was it? The Teachings of Carlos.
Teachings, I'm sorry. Excuse me, Carlos.
They presented Carlos as a young Puerto Rican artist who was possessed by an ancient spirit. They sold out the Sydney Opera House and then exposed themselves as a hoax and revealed that Carlos was actually Jose. Then, two decades later, Jose was revealed as Davy.
There was a knock on the door. It was some agents, government agents. They wanted to talk to me about passport fraud. This was the craziest moment of my life. And they put me in this place that I cannot even describe the horror of it.
It turns out that the true Jose Alvarez wasn't dead as Davey had been told. He had just applied for a passport. But luckily, at Davey's immigration hearing, hundreds of people showed up to testify on his behalf, and he wasn't deported.
However horrible, and it was really, really horrible, this whole situation, I am glad because now I can be myself. I can speak my truth. And I can tell people how this whole thing happened.
But still, some safeguards needed to be put in place. For starters, Randy still wasn't even openly gay.
It took me until into my 80s, and until suddenly I turned around and said, yeah, it's time.
This is the interesting thing, that we rationalize our position in life in order to be able to live with it, behave in a normal way, and not make a fuss. But we do have to always consider be as invisible.
Yeah. Invisible is the word.
We went and got married in Washington, D.C. on July 3rd. I kept telling Randy, we did it. We did it. We actually did it. I mean, we've been together for 27 years. But there is an actual change that happens internally. There is a certain sense of peace when you know, you feel you belong completely to this person and you two will be together forever.
And it's you're saying it to the world.
Yeah.
That's the important thing. Yeah. You're saying it to the world with no embarrassment whatsoever, no hesitation. Not at all.
It's a very powerful feeling and a very good one. And after all, it's just love.
For Latino USA, I'm Anna Adlerstein.
Randy and Davey have been married for over a year now. Davey's immigration status is still pending. This week, mis queridos, we're bringing you stories about falling in love, building relationships, or ending them. And all of that got us wondering, how are Latinos faring in their love lives? To discuss, we've invited award-winning poet, writer, and sex advice columnist Erica L. Sanchez, who recently tied the knot herself, to talk with us about all this. Hey, Erica. So how's it going?
It's been wonderful. I got married in July, and it's been great ever since. I never imagined myself getting married when I was young. I don't know why in the media there's always this idea of little girls imagining their wedding day. I never did. I imagined myself like traveling and writing and being successful.
So, ¿y tu mamá y tu papá? Were they just like, felices?
Yes, they were. They probably thought I was going to end up an old shrew by myself. I was always like the weird one in the family. So I think they were probably relieved.
Okay, so, you know, interestingly, last September, Pew reported that the number of Latinos and Latinas who have never married has actually doubled since 1980. So you're kind of going in reverse of the trend. Now, what do you think about that?
I was a little older when I got married. I mean, I'm 30. And, you know, by Mexican family standards, that's a little bit vieja. And so I was going to be a dejada, I think people were worried.
All right, well, let's focus on that word. The word is una dejada.
Una dejada.
Which mm-hmm. means like you're kind of left behind, right?
Yeah, it's a really sad term.
It is. It's like, la dejaron. She's just left. And it's actually only a female term, right?
Yeah, that's true.
There isn't a dejado.
No, there is not.
So another interesting study, in 2014, a Brookings study of census data found that interracial marriages are at an all-time high across the United States. For Latinos, 4 in 10 new marriages are to someone of a different racial group. Mostly white, mostly Anglos. Your marriage, in fact, is part of that 4 in 10 number. You decided to marry a man who is not Mexicano, not Latino.
Right. Yes, he's white.
And so was there any issue around that? Did that come up with your family? Was it a conversation at all?
In the beginning, my mom was concerned that his family would be racist. And I had to assure her many times that, you know, it was going to be okay and that they were nice people because she didn't know them.
And were you surprised when that came up?
I wasn't surprised at all. In fact, I kind of expected it. But I think just their interactions with people of that race were probably not the greatest. Growing up in, you know, I'm from Cicero, and it's primarily a, you know, working class Mexican neighborhood in Chicago. And I think my parents just assumed that white people look down on us, and a lot of times they do. And I think that does have a lot to do with the media and how we're presented and how, you know, there's all this anti-immigrant sentiment like constantly in the media that we're bombarded with. And so I think that was a culmination of a lot of factors.
So we've talked a lot about love and the good parts of love in your life. But what was the one loss in a relationship that you had a hard time getting over? Can you tell us?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I've had a few. But well, one was a long-distance relationship. I was living in Spain, and he was in Chicago. And that was a terrible idea. I mean, I was in Spain. I was 22. I was insecure. And he was also very insecure and very jealous. And so it was just dreadful. It was just a lot of crying over the phone. So I would not recommend a long-distance relationship. I mean, just based on my own experience. So that was a difficult relationship. We were very, very different. He was also of a different ethnicity. He was Pakistani, and we had very different worldviews, and we clashed all the time. But it was that kind of unhealthy obsession that you have when you're younger, in your younger years. And, you know, it was kind of awful, but kind of wonderful at times, too. So, I mean, I would never take that back. I mean, we had some great times.
So being able to say to him, your Pakistani lover, amor de lejos, amor de, he wouldn't get that.
No. That's what my mom kept telling me. My mom's always giving me these, you know, siempre me está dando estos dichos, you know, and that's what she told me when I was with that
amor
guy.
Amor de lejos, amor de...
Totally.
Erica Sanchez, thank you so much for joining us again on Latino USA.
Thank you so much.
Erica L. Sanchez is an award-winning poet, writer, and sex advice columnist. And if you want to find out more information about Latino relationships, visit our website, latinousa.org. And finally, dear listeners, we want to end this week's show with some sabiduría, or words of wisdom, from a Latina who's learned a lot from her long-distance relationship. Samantha Zelade is a 26-year-old graduate student in Austin, Texas. She tells us now about the challenges of being apart and what she's learned about love and letting go.
We met in Austin, Texas. He was playing with his band at South by Southwest, and I went to check out another show, another group from Colombia, and his band played before them. We got to talking and we hung out during the festival, and we continued correspondence online. I was actually dating someone at the time. We didn't take each other too seriously until after I'd broken up with my boyfriend. And around September, I got this wild hair and I said, "This guy really inspires me. He intrigues me. I don't care if distance, you know, plays any factor in this. I want to be with him." So I told him that I had bought a ticket to Colombia. And it surprised him. I remember getting off the plane and walking outside, and it was nighttime, and it was around Christmas time, so there were a lot of people flying in to see their families in Bogota. And I got very overwhelmed, and I didn't know if he was going to be able to find me, and I had no information, you know. Finally, after about half an hour going through the crowds, I saw him, and I had butterflies for sure. He booked us a ticket to go to Parque Tayrona, which is a national park on the coast. And, you know, we went camping
on the beach, and we slept in hammocks and definitely fell in love there. We would talk on the phone several hours a day. Wake up, call him. Call him on my way to school on the bus. Call him after my first class. Call him on my lunch break. Call him on my way home. After a while, I couldn't do that anymore, but I didn't know how else to nurture a relationship when all you have are your words. You have no physical touch. You know, there's so many things that you can show a person without saying anything. As a long-distance couple visiting each other, you're not living as a couple anyway. He would get up very early, and then I would wake up maybe an hour or two after that. And I had the mentality that I was on vacation, and that would kind of make him angry. And he's like, no, you need to get up, and we need to do things together. And maybe I would have a bowl of cereal by myself. And, you know, he's like, no, that's not the way it works. We have to have breakfast together. And then I would be confused, and I'm like, okay, well then I'll make you breakfast. And he's like, no, I don't want you to cook for me. I'm like, okay, I don't understand what's going on right now. He would take me on little day trips. We'd go to the Cathedral of Salt right outside of Bogota, but that ended up being a problem as well, because he didn't want us to feel like tourists every time we went to go see each other. He wanted to develop as much of a real relationship as we could. And, you know, feeling like we were on vacation every time we were seeing each other didn't lend itself to that. The distance was very difficult, and there were a lot of trust issues, many, many, many trust issues. Finally, we talked and we said, this isn't working, is it? And he said, no, this isn't working. And we said, okay, this is where it needs to end. He had a ticket booked already to come see me. So he said, well, what do you think if I just still come? I don't want to waste that ticket. And I said, okay. So after we broke up over the phone, we were able to see each other. And also, that was during South By. 2 years later, sealed the deal.
Before we go today, I just want to take a minute to thank all of you for your feedback on our episode last week about opening relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Some of you were thrilled with our coverage, and some of you were upset. Many, if not most of you, though, in either case, wanted more from us. More about the role of race in our shared history, the way tourism will change, the larger way that Cuba fits into our hemisphere. I just wanted to assure you that more is on the way, and that we know 1 hour is not enough to do justice to the U.S.-Cuba relationship. Stay tuned, folks, but do follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you really want to help us report this bit of history as it happens, well, visit our website and click the donate button. And that's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our intern is Laura Calzada. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on my Instagram. Hasta la próxima!
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the strengthening of international peace and security at carnegie.org.
God, I thought the sororities were some sort of like a juvenile version of the mafia.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. This year's recipients and more information are at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Queridos y queridas, if you love what we do here at Latino USA, I hope you'll take a moment to go to latinousa.org and click on the donate button to support our work. As you know, we're a nonprofit, so contributions from you, no matter what the size, are what makes this podcast possible. Gracias for believing in what we do. Do help us y hasta la próxima.